Jose Manuel Prieto moved to New York from Mexico in 2004 to accept a fellowship at the Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers. And we were all delighted when he and his wife and daughter decided to stay, thereby immeasurably increasing the cultural capital of New York. Born in Cuba, Jose moved to the Soviet Union to study engineering when he was 18, but he was already a writer and has continued, I mean, all his life he's been a writer. 12 years after moving to Russia, he and his Russian wife moved to Mexico, where he earned a PhD in history, and then on to New York. He's received numerous grants and awards, in addition to the Cullman Center Fellowship, from, among others, the Sistema Nacional de Creadores in Mexico, the Santa Madalena Foundation, the Latin American John Simon Guggenheim Foundation, and the Lannan Foundation. Jose writes for the New York Review of Books and The Nation and teaches literature at Seton Hall University. His books and essays have been published all over the world. The novels include the one we'll hear about tonight, Encyclopedia of a Life in Russia, as well as Rex and Nocturnal Butterflies of the Russian Empire. Those are the ones that have been translated into English, but there are many more. The translator of Encyclopedia of a Life in Russia and of Jose's terrific New York Review pieces is another former Cullman Center Fellow, Esther Allen. We didn't fix them up. They already knew each other. And they actually weren't here the same year, so we get no credit for that. Esther teaches at Baruch College in the CUNY system, and she works with French as well as Spanish. The authors she's translated, in addition to Jose, include Javier Marías, Jorge Luis Borges, Flaubert, Blaise Cendrars, Alma Guillermo Prieto, mentioned for the second time tonight, and Jose Marti. Among her edited publications are To Be Translated or Not to Be, and forthcoming this year, In Translation, Translators on Their Work and What It Means. She directed the Penn Translation Fund from 2003 to 2010 and co-founded the Penn World Voices Festival in New York. She's received numerous honors and awards as well, including a Fulbright and two NEA Translation Fellowships. And in 2006, the French government named her a Chevalier de l'Ordre des Arts et des Lettres, in recognition of her work promoting the culture of translation in the U.S. Joining Jose and Esther tonight as the moderator of their conversation is Keith Gessen, who was born in Moscow and moved to the U.S. with his family at the age of six. A journalist, novelist, editor, translator, and critic, he has written about Russia for The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, The London Review of Books, and The Atlantic. He published his first novel in 2008, All the Sad Young Literary Men, and is co-editor of N Plus One, which Mary Carr has called the best goddamn literary magazine in America. Please join me in welcoming three of the best goddamn literary figures in New York.
Okay. Thank you for that, Esther.
That was a very nice introduction. Let me start us off. Jose, you came to the Soviet Union in 1981 from Cuba. What was that like?
It was, I would like to thank Jean for the introduction and also the Cullman Center for the opportunity to be here this tonight. For me, it's a place where I spent a year working my novels, and so I have a very good... a very close relationship with this place. So, when I came to Russia in 1981, it was still the Soviet Union, and it was August. It was already cold. And I came from Cuba. It was a long trip, and I took it was a big ship, and then it was through Canary Island, then to Odessa, and then to Moscow, and then to Novosibirsk. It's a city in West Siberia. It was a great experience to be there. I didn't know how to dress myself because it was still already in the at the beginning of the autumn. It was already fall. It was already cold. But it was a very interesting experience for me. I met a lot of friends, and I met my wife, which, and I would say the related with the, to this novel, the most important part was the relationship I established with the Russian culture and Russian literature. I after all those years in Russia, and that, when I finished, even the four, when I was a junior, I started to translate Russian literature, and then I, for some reason I became very fluent in Russian. And so for me it was, you know, I had a friend who I met when I went to Russia the other, like 2 years ago. He was a big reader, and he, Igor, he was his name, he's a Russian guy. So he was a guy who also gave me many different books, and like Bulgakov, for example, at that point was in Samizdat, and you know, that kind of stuff.
You were coming from a poor communist country, and you were arriving at a different poor communist country.
That's true.
Which country was poorer?
That's a good question. Cuba, of course.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even Russia was, it all depends, you know, but Novosibirsk was it's a 5 hour flight from Moscow. It's in the middle of Russia, and then the many it's a difficult question to say because to answer because I was living in Havana, and then we had in Cuba many different kind of I would say advances or that we didn't have, I didn't find in Novosibirsk. But overall, of course, the situation in Cuba was poor, even now, of course. But, you know, I was young and I, if I went to Russia right now, knowing what I know now, I didn't stay for a minute. But it was a big adventure, and was very interesting, to be honest, because I was a big reader of Russian literature before I went. So for me, it was very curious. I was this curious idea of being, like, seeing what I was I knew from the Russian writers like Dostoevsky. I remember exactly before I went to Russia in that year. I read the Karamazov Brothers and many other that Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and everything. So for me, it was you know that was from that point of view was. And then the institute, the university when I where I started to study was you know like a very good university in Russia. And I found many interesting people there, but it was difficult. It was very.
If I can interrupt, you've skipped my favorite part of the story. Tell about the time you first saw snow.
Yes, that's correct. That's interesting. Yes, there was of course my first years. In Cuba we don't have snow. So there's a famous book that for a Cuban waiting for snow in Havana. So we're still waiting for snow in Havana. So, but I remember maybe in November because the first snow is in November. I was working doing some kind of technical drawings, and a guy who. Now I saw him like a few years ago. He was sitting next to me, a Russian, and he asked me, "You may?" Oh, he looked outside the window and said, "Ah, you maybe you don't know. You haven't seen the snow never." So he went outside and he grabbed like a snowball and put it to me in the table. It was wild, interesting. So it was, no, but he I think he was very smart now. He's like a big businessman in Russia. So, so yeah.
In your book, the encyclopedia, is arranged in alphabetical order, which we'll discuss presented problems for your translator. Mm-hmm. Arranged in alphabetical order and describes the various phenomena that you meet with in Russian life. The entry for lift, otherwise known as an elevator, has one of the many very sort of insightful and somewhat cutting remarks about the people of Russia. It says, "The people of Russia suffer from a compulsion to inventory the cosmos and make everything within it intelligible." And you make it sound almost like a disease. and yet your book is an attempt to chronicle the cosmos of what you call the Imperium, the Soviet Empire, right? So why did you write the book about Russia in that way?
This is a very, I think, it's an interesting question. I remember now, because when I started to work, to write it, I wrote this novel already 15 or 18 years ago. But at that moment, I was working as a translator from Russian literature, Soviet literature at that point, into Spanish. So when I said I had this idea of writing a novel that has the plot, the main characters and everything, but I realized that many of the contexts, many of the parts of the, for me, they are very clear. Maybe for the reader will be very difficult to understand what I'm talking about when I, for example, mention the lift or something else in that cosmos, as you say. So I started to write like small essays, more entries, and then I put it in alphabetical order, just to provide this kind of context for the, and then the novel took this form of an encyclopedia, and where you have the chronology of the events is altered, so you have. It follow now the order of the events follow the order, the alphabetical order of the entries, and but I think it worked, and and then I have this idea of, at some point I have the idea of to write novels using the kind of narrative mechanism that they weren't created to write novels, like the encyclopedia, like the commentary. This record is based on commentary, and the letter. So I at that point this was the first novel I wrote, but I had this idea of using that kind of, tension between the mechanism of the idea of the encyclopedia and the novels itself. No?
Your Spanish language readers would have been familiar with the elevator. So what is culturally specific about the lift in Russia?
But that's a good. What I put in that entry. Specifically, is the all the kind of instruction you will find in Russia, in the Soviet Union, like explaining everything in detail, how to behave, how do you know to behave. So, because I think it's Russia also, this is something from the totalitarian state, to something to have everything under control and to be able to predict every behavior, no? So, this is in the novel is something I found in the building I was living in St. Petersburg at that point, and that I remember I didn't have at that point I didn't take the picture. I just stand there and write down everything from that explanation. And the explanation is hilarious. I think they have want you to be. It's about the simple task of riding a lift. You write like an explanation. You put that in the elevator. How you need to behave? What you need to push and everything. So something like this. It's an absurd of this totalitarian state and the Soviet and the communism, I would say.
If I can address that too, as a translator, I was just reading some Chekhov letters that were translated by Michael Henry Heim. And at some point, Chekhov's writing a letter to Gorky.
So I want to address this notion of, oh my goodness, now it's really loud, all right? Is this okay now? Yeah? Okay. Sometimes the hardest things to translate are the things that your reader thinks they know what they are. So I was reading some letters from Chekhov to Gorky, translated by Michael Henry Heim, who's a brilliant translator, recently died. And at some point, Chekhov says to Gorky, your use of language is so sensual in this story that in the bakery, I can smell the rolls. And then there's a footnote from the translator. And he explains that the word in Russian is bubliki, which is bagels, which is quite simply bagels. But that if he had translated bagels as bagels, everyone would have imagined the story as taking place in Brooklyn, because the bagel in the U.S. context was so associated with a place in the United States. So I think in the case of something like Lyft, yes, it is a kind of translation, because obviously a Cuban knows what an elevator is, but you would never find in Cuba, and I just have to read the first couple of these instructions because they're hilarious. Regulations for usage of the passenger elevator. Number one, this elevator is intended for the transportation of passengers, furniture, and other objects of quotidian use. Number two, to summon the empty car, activate the button located next to its entrance on every floor on the external side. After the call button has been pressed, wait for the car to arrive. Number three, when the car arrives at the floor from which the call was made, the doors of both elevator shaft and car will open automatically. And it goes on for like 11 more instructions like that. So that is a translation of Lyft, because in Cuba, such a thing would be unimaginable as you know, yes, in association with an elevator, which, you know. So sometimes the most obvious things to translate are the most difficult.
Yes, well, but and yet, I mean, Cuba, as we said, is also a communist country, right? So how different was that? Was it a very different reality in terms of this kind of authoritarian?
Yes, I would say in Cuba it's in a way softer. It's not in the way that. But also the Cuban came to the communism like 50 years after that, or 10 years after the Russians, or maybe 40, I don't remember. So you have different kind of approach of the government to, for example, I was a Russian journalist, Alexander Genis, so he was telling me that in Russia, in the Soviet Union in the 60s, they will say, oh, in Cuba they allow the abstract painting, you know, the extractionism and everything, because for the Russians it was prohibited. So we were in different kind of Cuba is a Western country, more in the Western kind, and was very close to the state. So it was a big difference, mm-hmm, I felt, when I came to Russia, of course.
And I also felt in the book, as you kind of roll out these encyclopedia entries, there's a kind of despair about any two cultures being comprehensible to one another. There was a line in the Raskolnikov entry, which I thought was very interesting. You tell this kind of horrible story about a collector of, mm-hmm, antiques who was robbed, and then, but the thieves don't steal all his stuff, and then as the sort of crime scene, and he's murdered, right? And as the crime scene is being investigated, he's robbed again and again and again. And after this, you say, do all of you out there understand? From here on, I'm expecting you to lend a bit more credence to what I'm telling you. What did you mean by that?
No, the idea is that it's like when you know, I think, of course, this is famous, Marco Polo, when he came back from China, people thought that he was lying, no?
Wasn't he lying?
No. But then it's difficult to convey your experience to people, they don't know what you're talking about. So this is something that I found that people will, you know, it's difficult. It's another universe. Mm-hmm. This is a book about a traveling to some other universe and what I saw there, and I'm putting there in a way in the form of a novel, mm-hmm, and all my surprises, all my observations about literature about the way the Russians, for example, love poetry and or my observation about everything. So I put together in the book. So they have how many? I don't remember how many entries, but they are like I don't remember the name. Oh, we don't have that. They this is. So they are like entries like White Nights is referring to the not Dostoevsky and then, but many others like Raskolnikov and
Vanilla Ice.
Vanilla Ice, yes. The snow, and you know, it's kind different kind of how to the step, mm-hmm. And the magic flow, and many others. So it's about this is an inventory of. Of my surprises. It's the same that the Marco Polo's book. He went to China when he was 19 and he became very fluent in Chinese or I believe so. Yeah. So so this is I had this that's what I call Encyclopedia of a Life in Russia. I have this urgency of writing about all of that.
So Esther, so Jose put you in a bad spot by making it alphabetical, and how did you deal with that?
Well, Jose's put me in a lot of bad spots. he delights in torturing translators, but it's super interesting to translate him because he is a translator, so he understands that work is transformed by translation because he's been involved in that process himself, as have you. So. Which is a very different thing than working with somebody who has some notion of, you know, trying to exert absolute control on the end product. But we discussed it, and my initial idea was we'll just translate the text and it'll reshuffle itself as a new alphabetical order comes into play. And so it'll be a different book because it'll be in a different order. And we played with that idea, and then Jose pointed out, and I gradually realized that there is a narrative, although the narrative is kind of covert. But there is a narrative, and there is an order to that narrative that kind of swims in between the arbitrary alphabetical order. So it was important that it be preserved pretty much. And so then that was a really interesting process, because all of these solutions kind of emerged out of the logic of the book itself. There is a lot of Latin in this book, which is not illogical, given that Jose's last book was called Rex, which is, you know, a nice Latin name that solved the problem of translation of the title for every single language that it's been translated into. And things like imperio in Spanish are spelled with an I. So if you move that empire into English, you've altered the order, and that was important. So Richard Kapuscinski has a great book called Imperium. So the word has already been used in the English context for the Soviet Empire, and it worked. You know, just started doing that. And Jose already throughout the book refers to Moscow as the Grand Duchy of Muscovy. So it fit with all sorts of other games that were going on. And so the solution had to kind of work and fit in with, some of them are a little more awkward. Aldea is village in Spanish, obviously from A to V. It's a big step, so we titled that one Agriculture. And then we had a little paren, as practiced in villages. and that gave us the opportunity to put village in all caps as an entry throughout. So we played with it.
But some things did move.
A little bit. A little bit, not too far. Nothing moved very far.
I see, okay.
No, actually, it's wonderful. I always thought that it would be impossible to translate this book.
Do you know Latin?
No.
I was amazed. You know, the Pope today, he retired in Latin. And I was like, how do people know that he retired?
They use Google Translate.
Yes, that's correct. No, but the Spanish language is very close to Latin. All the modern languages, it's even closer. I read in one book than Italian. People would say that, would think that Italian, but, you know, I don't know Latin, but in the book there are a lot of different languages because of the idea of the encyclopedia. And then I found when I was writing the book, it was 1993, I was living in St. Petersburg at that point, and that I found very, wonderful encyclopedia in Spanish, but it was from some German town. It was one of the war retribution from the from Germany, so it had like a stamp from that town, and it was very helpful for me, you know, because the old encyclopedias they don't write that kind of encyclopedia anymore. There were a lot of different stories and like, details, and reading a very good Spanish language from the 19th century. Yeah. So.
One of my private theories is that the book is an encyclopedia because Vissarion Belinsky, the 19th century Russian critic, very famously called Pushkin's Eugene Onegin, I say Eugene Onegin, an encyclopedia of Russian life.
Yes.
So calling this book Encyclopedia of a Life in Russia was a way of capturing that antecedent, that literary intertextuality, and then doing it as an encyclopedia emerged out of that, perhaps?
Sounds good.
So the book is also very much about the collapse of the empire and the kind of moment of values crumbling and being replaced by. It wasn't really clear what, I mean, money, of course, right? Can you talk a bit about that, what that was like? I mean, you watched this happen.
Yes, this is one of the most important parts of the book. This is a book about how to survive the crumble, the fall of the empire, when the people, I have in one of the entries about this, about how it's to wake up in the morning and to know that the doctrine doesn't exist anymore, doesn't work anymore. So it's about this strategy of how to survive. And then the part of the consumerism and the dandyism and everything is about how to, in a situation of the totalitarian state that was in Russia and in Cuba, you are able to find like a private world in that sense. So. It's very important to people to know, to be able. It's difficult to understand if you don't how important it is to see a very good Western movie or to be able to buy something from that world that is some kind of chimera, you know, when you are inside. So the book is about that, about how this person. It's a journey of his liberation of the indoctrination of the from the government and from above.
you mean the narrator?
Yes.
So the narrator coming. I don't know if we're told this, but we might assume from Cuba. Right, he said. We know that he's not Russian, Yerush, right? Mm-hmm. And so he is liberated from Cuban communist ideology in the Soviet Union.
This is the end of the Soviet Union.
Right.
This is the end this other book was published recently, came out like Caviar with Rum. It's an academic book, but we did it with the professor Jacqueline Loss. I don't know if she's here.
Jackie.
So this is about how the Russian, all the perestroika ideas, the effect that had in Cuba was a big effect. Mm-hmm. So you know, it was for everybody inside that. World of the communists was a big liberation to know that there was a huge mistake, that you know that now finally we understand that there is a way out of that nightmare for Cuba, for people in Cuba, for people in Bulgaria, for people everywhere. We were inside that empire in a way, you know. So it wasn't very important. The perestroika was for my generation was very important. This is a book about that in a sense also.
But your narrator, he adopts a very different ideology. I mean, he falls in love with money, and with spending money.
But that's happening. What's happening in Russia also.
Uh-huh.
I believe will happen in Cuba. So in a way, you know, it's in Russia we have all those people, you know, spending a lot of the millionaires and the oligarchs and everything, you know. So this is something that, because it's a vacuum and it's replaced by that in a way, by money, you know. Maybe it's difficult to understand that in the West, but.
Well, I actually think it's interesting to read this book 20 years later, right? Because it was written 20 years ago, so it's a little bit of a time capsule about that period. And to read it 20 years later in the United States in the wake of an economic collapse within the capitalist system, which was supposed to be the solution when this book was being written. And it's interesting, a lot of the people who've reviewed it don't seem to notice that it was written 20 years ago. Very few people have picked up on that because it seems so relevant to what's happening here now. And to sort of, you know, at the end, the character is being chased by thugs and he's convinced everybody that he has a lot of money, but he pulls out his wallet and it's just credit cards. And he just throws these credit cards down at the feet of the thugs and he doesn't actually have any money. And and people read that, you know, in the United States in 2013, and they don't think that it's about, you know.
The guy was talking about the one who put the snowball. When I went to Russia many years after that, in the Soviet historical years, he said, "Oh, where are you?" "I'm in that place." I was in OCB. So he came. He was in the Mercedes and big Mercedes. He wanted to show me how rich he was. Was, you know, with some wolf skin and everything. You know, was like for him was a very big deal to show me how rich he became. And this is something that is happening in Russia. Maybe I don't know. Russia is a very rich country in a way, you know. So, but this is about that. It's about the how do you live in that kind of country.
Well, but you talk about the nightmare of the Soviet Union for a lot of people.
You don't agree with that.
Sorry?
For
a lot of people, the post-Soviet, you know, the 90s were a much worse nightmare. You know, I mean, the 90s made the Soviet Union look not so bad.
That's true.
What do you think?
I don't know. No comment. No.
Yes, a stalemate.
No, I left Russia in 1994 to Mexico, but I was traveling all the time, and of course the situation was very bad in the 90s. It was a vacuum of power and then the criminality and everything. But in the other hand, it was a feel of liberation, and 1991 was a very important year. And then many of the institutions they have right now in Russia, in the Soviet Union, they were created in that year. It was a revolution happening. Of course, the revolution is a very bad moment to leave, you know.
And if I can add something to that, if the 90s were bad in the Soviet Union, try Cuba in the 90s. Mm-hmm. So the periodo especial. So, you know, one of the things to remember is that Jose is a Cuban writer, and which is very easy to forget when you're talking about his work as we are now. And this book still hasn't been published in Cuba. You know, only recently have you started going back a little bit in the last year or so. And none of your work has been published in Cuba since your first book of short stories.
That's true, yes.
So, you know, the idea of the collapse of the Soviet Union, you know, that it might have had a traumatic aftermath still seems viewed from within the context of Cuban history, far preferable to.
Right. And I guess we'll know that Cuba is having its perestroika when they publish this book. That'll be the sign.
That will be the sign. That will be the sign. Yes. Not just in this book, many other books. You know, there are a lot of writers who live outside Cuba that they don't have the book published in Cuba. So the situation is very interesting. So, but you know, we have the, for the Cuban writer, for me, we are in a very different situation that for the Russian, because we speak Spanish, we write in Spanish. So we are able to publish in Mexico or in Spanish, in Spain or whatever. So I have all my books have been published in Spain, and I have my public there, and also in Mexico, many of the countries. So they know about me in Cuba, but you know, of course, I would like to be published, of course.
For a Russian writer, that would be like if there was Russia, but you couldn't publish in Russia, but there was a much bigger Russia.
That's correct.
Somewhere else, but that would be a very big. That would be a very big country.
That'd
yeah,
really be a very
yeah,
large
that'd be
country.
Really big. Yeah. How your translation? You've also translated Akhmatova, Brodsky. Were those published in Cuba?
No. Also in Spain and Mexico. But all my translations have been published in, outside Cuba, yes. Huh. In Cuba, I would say I'm not a writer.
No, a friend of mine was we organized something with Jose like 8 or 9 years ago, and she was at the, she was in Havana at the Cultural Institute in Havana, and she was showing the things that she was presenting as part of the series about Cuban culture at the New School. And they pointed to Jose's name, and they said, why do you have him on there? He's not a Cuban writer. He only writes about Russia. I hazard that perhaps writing about Russia is a way of writing about Cuba. One more way of writing about Cuba?
No, it was a period, and now I have to know more. The novel I researched when I was in the library, it's about a human voice, it's about singing. And then I finished another one, it takes place in New York. It's a novel about, I don't want to say about what it's about, but it's a novel that takes place here. So it was a period of my life, and then, I am very happy. In a way, I was at some point thinking about that. Of course, it was a nightmare when I came there, but on the other hand, it was a blessing to go to Russia and to spend those years there. It was very formative for me, and you know, it's a life in Russia. This is the life. You cannot see, look back and say, wow, I would like to change this and that. No, it's my life, and then I have this. Another like a sensibility and something like that.
Can you tell the story about the Gabriel Garcia Marquez story that you told us, the tribute to Gabo? Sorry, my favorite stories that I like to hear about seeing the Kremlin in the middle of Novosibirsk.
Yes, that was my first winter, and I wrote a piece, a short piece, about when it was Esther organized. Homage for Garcia Marquez, and because Garcia Marquez, his 100 years of solitude, he has this passage about this guy going and discovering the ice. So I was in the same situation when I went to Russia. In that winter, I remember they built like a small castle of ice with ice blocks. I was wild, very surprised by that. And I went, like in the novel, but to touch the ice, and so I wrote this. And I still remember that story. That was, you know, it's completely. I would like the public maybe to read the novel and to be able to find out this. For me, it's a conversation with the young person I was like 25 years ago, and then I found he was very.
What did you mean when you said earlier that if you knew then what you know now, you would never have set foot?
It's something you say sometimes to yourself it's a science fiction, in a way, science fiction. But because it was something where I'm on the other side, but it took me a lot of effort to get through. When I was there, and one of the reasons I became so fluent in Russian was because when I came, I was an avid reader when I was a child in Cuba, and then I didn't find any books in Spanish in Novosibirsk. It was in the middle of Russia, so they didn't have any. It was like a small shelf with, I don't know, maybe 100 books in Spanish. So I read all of them in maybe 2 months or 3 months, I don't know. And then I started to read in Russian. So, but that was very hard at the very beginning, and then I had I sometimes I dreamt that I hear the radio in Spanish, something like that. You know, we didn't have any email or whatever at that point. It was difficult.
It was difficult.
But it was an experience of that. But for me, I found many. There is an excerpt of this Japanese writer Tanizaki, Junichiro Tanizaki. When I came to Russia, I found out the Russian has a very good tradition of translating Japanese literature into Russian, because they are neighbors and everything. So for me, it was a window to the Japanese culture and to the many other cultures being in Russia. So until recently, they didn't, in Spain, we didn't have the most famous books, Genji Monogatari.
This is the Tale of Genji.
Tale of Genji. So we have the very small translation in Spanish, but in Russian they have everything, so the whole book. So I still have the Russian edition of that. So, you know, it was a very, that kind of. But then, after many years, I realized that I need to leave Russia by any means. So I started to. This is what happened in my second novel. I started to smuggling stuff and try to make money. You know, and then I was traveling to many other countries and buying stuff from the Russian, the Soviet army.
You're an arms trader?
Night vision goggles.
Yes. Optical part.
Okay. Harmless.
Harmless, yes. Yes. Huh.
Was that legal? Can we talk about that?
No, it wasn't legal. Of course not.
No. Okay.
It was something. It was smuggling. It was buying something here and selling across the border, without any declaration, without anything. So making money out of it. And it was a fantastic life in a way. You know? No, it was very interesting. And then I made enough money to leave Russia. And to write the book, because at some point I said, well, I need the money to make a fellowship for myself. So I will stop at this point, and then was what happened. I made an amount of money, and then I started to write the novel. So my wife, she was pregnant at the moment, and we have my daughter. I was working home and writing the novel. But for that, I had to, you know, because I didn't. I was working as a translator. That works disappear. As an engineer, I was like the same situation we have in Cuba now. So I started to. I have a friend, and we, for the first time, we went to Berlin. When the war fell, and I bought some Soviet stamps. I thought it was a fantastic business, but it didn't worth any money. No, it was. And then we took those stamps to Berlin, and I was very hopeful that they would cost a lot of money, but it wasn't. And then I realized that the best would be to buy those night vision goggles.
So you tried to sell stamps. It wasn't
as a writer.
Yeah. Yes, and that didn't work, and so you went over
just
to
writer,
military hardware. Yeah.
No, yes, but it was a fantastic business. Let me say.
The night vision goggles.
Night vision goggles. And then my character in the novel in Livadia, that's why. And then he met this prostitute in Istanbul and everything. You know, that's that kind of story. And it was more interesting than what I'm doing now.
be more interesting than this?
That's true. And I'm a professor.
Yes, it's probably for the best. You know, that's,
maybe.
Yeah, some of these guys who've been smuggling arms, they don't.
It takes a.
Yeah, they get yes. caught. They
takes
get caught.
A lot out
yeah,
of you.
Yeah, it takes a lot out of you. Yeah, age, a lot of gray. Yes.
Yeah, that's true.
Should we take some questions? Questions? Yes.
If I may ask two questions, actually. One is about Prussia, sort of, but the other one is purely literary. I'll start with the literary one. Writing a novel in encyclopedic form, in alphabetical order, with a covert narrative, are you familiar with Uito in Literature and the Constraint? No?
Ulipo. Oh!
La escuela francesa de
yes. With the introduction of life. How is that?
La vie, vida, moda de empleo. Georges Perec.
De Georges Perec.
Yeah.
Yes. I am familiar with that, but I don't think I had that in mind when I was.
Okay.
But I, of course, it's something. Or maybe yes. But I remember, at that point, I just knew. Las Cosas de Perec. I don't know the name of it.
The Things.
The Things.
Yeah.
I think it's his first novel.
Mm-hmm.
But didn't know all the late novels about. But I was studying engineering. For me, it's a very important part, the permutational part of the. So that's something I was thinking when I was doing. And then we have in Spanish also this famous book by Cortázar.
Hopscotch, Rayuela.
Yes. So, you know, so it's,
The second question is, are you familiar with Ilyichevsky's Matisse, which is really, for me, the book about the 90s in Russia?
Not this one.
it's the other book.
In Russia, my field is really...
No, I'm not familiar with that.
I think you'd see both the, you know, what you were describing, the sort of also the vacuum where, you know, translator's job disappear, engineering job disappear, everybody, you know, all the tethers and all the anchors disappear.
Mm. Oh, interesting.
And money becomes, as you were saying, you know,
the center of the...
I think you mentioned it in a book, but it's not translated into English.
Oh, okay.
All the better.
Well,
it's in Russian, of course.
Okay, excellent.
Yes.
This is a very good point. This, for my narrator, that he's like he develops different like relationship with this phenomenon. So in this novel, of course, he's like looking after that, like trying to make money and everything. But at the end, when he found this family in the last novel, the trilogy in Rex, so he's very critical. Toward them, toward those, the idea of became of the money and everything. So, his attitude toward this change. Of course, everything you need to the idea of the money having this kind of influence is something that is important when you are inside that kind of system. Not for me in this situation. Not for me. Not outside Russia. Not outside that totalitarian. But you need. It's something to dream about when you are, you know, living that poor life in the material sense. That's what it's about. I think so.
Yes. Oh, yes. Second row.
Adjust to the culture. Were there any other Spanish-speaking people, and how did you learn the language? Russian is not that easy, and you said you picked it up pretty fast.
but it was very common at that point from to Cuban students to go to Russia to study. So I have friends, of course, they went where with me. I wasn't alone in Russia. So there was with one of them, I'm still friend, and many others are there. So they have a group of Cubans living there. But our university, they had this point: you have to live with Russian in the same room to be able to become familiar with the language. And then, but I don't know. I believe it's because I started to read in Russian, and then at some point, many of my friends, they went to make money. They went to some factories to work as workers, you know, like night shifts, and to make some money as students. But I went once, and then I thought that it would be better if I do some translations. That would be easier. So
you had also studied Russian before in Havana.
Yes, no, but just in the school, like something from 1 year.
In the Escuela Lenin.
Yes. But you know, something happened. I didn't put any effort to that. It just happened the way things happen when you are young. I believe so.
So you decided translating would be easier than working.
That's correct. That was another incentive.
There's a question in the third row.
Yes. Jose, when you were working on the novel, did you have an imagined primary audience? Behind that is the question of, okay, if you did, was it Cuban or Mexican or Russian?
This is a good question. I don't... in a way, I would say yes. I think sometimes when I write, if they are difficult to read or something like that, they are complex in the way, you know, the novels I've been written. I think I have a few friends in mind who will read the novel. So I believe if they understand the novel, so the novel will work. But it's impossible to have in mind all the readers. And then, having in mind a good reader, right? In the sense, in the first point, it's you. I should be satisfied with them. But then, so it's not that easy to. That's a good question, because it's not that if you are not translated, you don't have translation of your own works. It's difficult to have this feeling how it will work with other audience in some other languages. I have this confirmation. I had many times in Germany and in French, in Italy. So for me, it's, I understand that I don't need to think about them. But it's enough to think about one, two, three very good readers, and then it will work. So having very good reviews, and I'm very surprised, to be honest, because you never know how people will be able to understand the book, understand, you know.
Also, you're a very good translator.
That's true. That's true. That's also very important, and I'm very happy with that, because I have my translator from into German. She's a fantastic translator. The French into France, into French also, she's a fantastic. And the Italian one is also, but I don't know how it works in some other languages, you know. In Russian also is a very good translation. So
the Russian translator adds footnotes.
Ah, yes.
Wow.
He says.
Yes.
What might that transition look like, and then what might it look like afterwards? I think think there's often an impression in America that that it is just waiting for, you know, the death of these two significant figures, and then it'll kind of maybe convert back to being the American style casino colony that it was in 1954.
This is a very complex question, because you know, it based on kind of ideas I don't have the same point of view. I don't believe that Cuba was a colony before the 1959, and it was a very close country to America, but no, it wasn't a colony. And then I don't believe after the Castro brothers died, something will have changed dramatically. To answer that question, I need an hour. Something will happen, maybe, but I don't know. What this is.
There'll be more American cars. They'll get new American cars.
That would be the best part, I believe.
But I mean, there's a great. What do you think of contemporary American cars? There's an amazing passage about how you feel like they've lost. Well, as of 20 years ago, they had lost the kind of greatness of the 1950s American car. Is that true? Is that still true? Or are they improving?
No. Yes, I have this idea of writing a book about American cars. So I have about my childhood in Cuba, about the what, you know, how it was before in the 70s when I was a child in Cuba. So. But I don't think it's a easy question to answer. That kind of, you know, I don't know. I don't in my novels I don't approach that kind of. It doesn't. But I do write some nonfictions, and I have something published and about what's happening in Cuba. But it's impossible to figure out what is going to happen. So.
Okay, take that.
Disconnect between reality and ideology, whether the ideology of communism or the ideology of money, mm-hmm. capitalism. So what I was curious about was, in terms of the work that you're doing now, is there a particular kind of disconnect that you find very compelling in your imagination that you'd like to write about next?
I don't know. It's interesting because I don't... you don't write thinking about that. I am writing about the disconnection of something with that, with something else. So you write, it's about stories, and then it happened to be about disconnection. But the novel I've just, one of the novels, it's about the human voice, about the emotional impact of the voice, of the singing. So it's something that, something else. And then, no, it's maybe... If you will suggest me something.
That's correct.
And then I haven't really known, but I now see that that's from the elevator, and going to the USSR and finding out that they have to teach them how to use an elevator, it would be Cuban or Brazilian before, because we were there.
That's a very good. That's a very good observation. That's very interesting. Yes, when I came, I remember this is to this day. I remember we were in the. This was a huge ship in Odessa. Some other student, some other girl was from other. She came 2 days before or something like that, and she was standing there and was saying, "Oh, he's horrible." To all of, and we were, what? We for us was impossible to believe that. So what she was telling us, how bad was in Odessa, about the toilets, about how everything was, you know, but for her was a shock. to find out when she came, also for me, I was expecting something, you know, because she was indoctrinated, and that Soviet Union was, what, as you said, way up ahead of us, and then we will find something, you know, in the future. Science fiction, something. It was terrible. It was a shock. It was a huge surprise, to be honest. Because, you know, the propaganda and the whole, the Sputniks and the whatever it was, the Soviet propaganda was that everything was fine, everything was fantastic, everything. But when I came, I found things that it was, even for us, in Cuba, was impossible to you know, to fit. So that's a good point, yes. But I don't write about that, and I don't believe that was important. Then I found that's the important part. I think when I went to Russia, I went to the Soviet Union, but I found Russia. That's completely different. So I found another country behind that country, the propaganda, and that's a normal country with wonderful people, with wonderful culture, and that's what I wrote about. That's what I write about, not about the Soviet Union and the. That was very interesting to me. No? I think that at some point they realized that this is Russia is something else that the Soviet Union was. It's more important and more interesting, much interesting. But that's.
Yes. Yes,
I think in any case, when you came in contact with other people, that will affect them. So I don't have any idea how all those people think about what was their relationship with the Cubans and the impact they had on them. But of course, I believe in some aspect we were able to. Introduce something, I don't know, maybe salsa music? Something, I don't know, but it's just very interesting. For me, it's difficult to calibrate that. No?
I can add that when Jose's novel, Livadia, was translated into Russian, it was hailed as the first great Russian novel written in Spanish. So that's a contribution.
That's a contribution. Oh, that's true.
So I don't know if you quote that time, but were you surprised that that Russians accepted that?
Yes, that was a big surprise, but for everybody, I've seen. It was a famous Mexican telenovela. Right. The rich also cried.
Los ricos también lloran.
And then the Brazilian, there was
and the Russians all started naming their sons Jose Antonio and things like that. Yeah.
It was a huge impact. But yes. Octavio Paz. He used to say that Russia is on the edge of this, on the Western world, and also Latin America on the other side, on the edge of the world. So we have that in common. So all undeveloped in the way, you know, and then also part of the Western, but not entirely Western countries. So I think that's a connection we have in this. But that's a very interesting question, because for the Russian, that part of the low culture and the soap opera, so for them was very, like, a very entertaining and something new, but because they have Tchaikovsky, Bach, Mozart, but not soap operas.
Junk. No junk.
Although, as you point out, the last emperor of the Soviet Empire, right before he was forced to leave the scene, met with the scorpions.
That's correct.
Yes.
I mean, Gorbachev.
Why? Because they had that song?
But no, because the scorpions were famous at that point, so it's something he did the last week.
Yeah. But it collapsed in such ignominy. The great experiment.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, two more. And yes. You first.
Say it again, I didn't get that one too
much. Well, you did mention that your encounter of ice was amazing. Mm-hmm. That you touched the city or whatever it was made of. And the fact that Russians had a lot of international literature translated. Was there anything else that you encountered that amazed you?
Translated into Russian?
Yeah.
From other. Oh, of course, many, the food, and I don't know.
Poetry? Russian poetry.
The abacus, everything
the
that's
abacus,
in this
yeah.
book.
Everything, yes. The whole inventory is in the book.
Yes. Okay, last question.
My question is, as a Cuban, living in the Soviet Union during the 90s, how much
it was difficult. The moment when everything collapsed, and then it was difficult for everyday life. But I don't know it's. I don't think I understand very well.
The relationship with you living in the Soviet Union, mm-hmm.
Okay.
What is the similarity? How you cope with that? Certainly.
It was difficult. I would say it was terrible. It was difficult in a way that I didn't expect that. When I was studying there, I had this idea of what. So my wife, and so. So I will go to work and have my, my salary. And as an engineer, I worked as an engineer there in Cuba and then also in Russia. So for me and for many people, it was like everything disappeared. It was a moment of. And then I saw the other day this my Perestroika, the documentary film, and that everything is there. It's about wow. But that's why I left Russia in a way, because I went to Moscow because it's another completely another life. But in the whole experience was I think I am happy that it did happen that way. And but I would like to say thanks to Esther for the wonderful translation. You see, she's the
thanks to Jose.
No, because it was difficult. I believe it's very difficult. It was difficult too. And then you did a wonderful work. And thank you for your wonderful questions. Okay. I know I've taken your function, no? You are the one.
Oh, yes. You're now. Well, I will thank the audience,
yes.
And also for all the questions with these wonderful accents. Yeah. It's been the most variety of incredible accents. And
yeah, Jean, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to Jean and Lorraine. Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming. Yes.